I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's now been 2.5 years since the Black Turban Taliban soldiers ran for the hills of Afghanistan. Since that time, Afghans have seen the start of the reconstruction of their country and the first steps toward democracy. Remember back in those early days, U.S. soldiers and politicians were working closely with counterparts in Pakistan, hunting bin Laden together, reviving a cooperation between America and Pakistan that had lain dormant for decades. But a funny thing happened along the way. New York Times correspondent who's been covering both Afghanistan and Pakistan says it's actually the Afghans who seem to be a little bit more committed to democracy these days. Pakistan, he says, remains home to the more volatile base of Islamic fundamentalism. David Rode is here with me this hour. You're welcome to join our conversation. Do you think there's a danger that Afghanistan and Pakistan have slipped too far from America's priority list? Should the U.S. be doing more to make sure that Islamic extremism can't grow, that bin Laden's people can't gain strength once again? How much responsibility does this country have to support reform and pay for reconstruction? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Rode won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from the former Yugoslavia. He has been based in South Asia for the past 2.5 years with the New York Times. He's now in Boston on a fellowship, but joining me here in our Connection studio. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
We have spoken over long-distance phone lines a number of times, so it's good to meet face-to-face. I want to go straight to news from the region that we got this week, and there's actually lots to talk about. But word from Afghanistan that a fellow by the name of Abdulrashid Dostum, the Uzbek northern warlord, as we called him, is now going to be a key part of the Hamid Karzai cabinet. A lot of people are looking at this and saying, what does that mean for Afghanistan? This guy has a trail of human rights accusations and abuses behind him that were supposed to be sort of left out of this government. What do you think?
It's, an attempt by Karzai's government to co-opt him and to get him out of northern Afghanistan, which is his power base, and bring him down into Kabul. It's a real risk, though, because the elections there were a mandate against the warlords and for reform and for a different group of Afghans to start leading the country. People in Afghanistan say that this is Karzai has a short window to now to really act, to really deliver in terms of changing Afghanistan, and it's, I think it's a gamble what he's trying to do.
Dostum actually ran for the president.
He was a distant fourth. He was supported by Uzbeks. He's sort of seen as the Uzbek strongman, and the Uzbeks are concentrated in northern Afghanistan. But Karzai's great success was actually receiving votes from across all ethnic groups to unite the country. So. I think it's divided Afghans, and I think Westerners that are there, whether this is, an effective or wise strategy. There was a desire among many people for Karzai to be much more decisive and take on these people. His approach has been very Afghan, which is keep everyone in the tent.
Right.
There are Westerners who were like, you've got the democratic mandate, just throw these guys out of power. He's afraid, I think, of marginalizing anyone or forcing anyone to take up arms. So I would, watch this one very closely, but I would, I think it's too early to condemn it at this point.
There's a young man who you met early on in your time in Afghanistan. I think he was working as a translator for you, helped you right as the Taliban were leaving Kabul. I think you use him as an example of the kind of change that we're seeing below the sort of political level. Can you tell us about him?
His name is Abdulwahid Wafa, and he was my translator. He's, to me, an example, actually, of, Afghanistan today is a success story, I think. He fled Kabul to come work with journalists that he heard were on the other side of the front line to try to make money so that he could smuggle his family out of Kabul. His family was they're ethnic Tajiks, and the Taliban were arresting ethnic Tajiks. They had arrested his father and tortured him at one point because most Tajiks fought in the Northern Alliance against the Taliban. When Kabul fell, I took him back into the city. He was terrified that his father had been rearrested and possibly killed. And I remember bringing him back to his house. And happily, his father was alive. His family hadn't been harmed. And lots of tears that day. The house was, run down. No running water, no electricity. Today, Wahid is a law student. I went back to his house to say goodbye to him when I left 3 weeks ago, and the house has been repainted. There's still the electricity hasn't been fixed, and the his younger brother's in college, his father's employed, And the funniest thing was that there was a brand new TV, and I, this is sort of a sad, but, you know, a reality check into what the United States has brought Afghanistan. They were happily watching this new independent television station that's been started with some help from USAID money. And there was actually an excellent and very professional independent news broadcast that had news from around the world that sort of criticized Karzai. It was very impressive, and that's a big success story there. And then we sat and watched an Afghan version, basically, of Candid Camera, where there was a young man who had one arm in a cast and another arm was holding a bag, and he's standing on the streets of Kabul walking up to these incredible Afghan figures, men with long beards and men in turbans, and saying, "Please, sir, my back itches, and can you, my back, you know, it's a terrible itch, can you please scratch my back for me?" And watching these Afghan, you know, businessmen and tribesmen and, you know, sort of looking at him. And the funny thing was that most people did scratch his back. But they were so thrilled and empowered to be able to see their own world on TV. And a normal image of an Afghanistan that you know, is growing. And there's a tremendous sense of, I think, pride and still hope in the country. And Wahid, who's become a great friend of mine, I think is an example of that. And it's courageous Afghans that are making this work. I mean, obviously, the United States plays a critical role there, and I think it would fall apart if the United States were to leave, but it's courageous Afghans like him that are making change happen there.
Let's talk about a story that's in the newspaper this morning here in America. Word from the House Republicans that after having reviewed the budget request of the president, they're looking at dropping over, what, $500 million from the Afghan aid package. Can you give us some context for that if it were to go through, David?
I'm not sure the exact numbers, but I think this represents as much as half the reconstruction money for Afghanistan, or I would say at least 30%. It would have a tremendous impact in Afghanistan in that things – there was very little funding actually in 2002 and 2003 for reconstruction in Afghanistan. 2004, there was a supplemental $1.7 billion put in. Many Afghans cynically said this was about having a peaceful and successful presidential election in Afghanistan, which was in October of last year, so that it would be a positive issue for President Bush. If this money is cut now, it's going to play into that cynicism.
And do you think that the hold that Karzai has, or his ability to make his case that democracy is the best thing for that country, is in any way dependent on maintaining that kind of support?
Oh, there's no question that Karzai is associated with reconstruction and aid from the West. That's largely many Afghans said they voted for him simply because there's been 3 years of peace in Afghanistan, and after 25 years of war, that is an invaluable thing. So if the money is seen as slipping, and he still has only a rudimentary government, the Afghan National Army only has about 20,000 soldiers in it. It's been a very difficult process to train it, to make it ethnically balanced, but it's generally functioning well. There's an effort to train new policemen, but it's very much a rudimentary state. And cutting this kind of money, there's an enormous problem with opium going on. There's ambitious plans by the U.S. to try to convince farmers to grow alternative crops. All of this takes money. And, you know, the United States walked away from Afghanistan, you know, after the Soviets withdrew, and unfortunately we saw the result. And it came back to literally cost us American lives. So,
Well, what's the risk this time around? I mean, we kind of need to remind ourselves that the Taliban were not an invading force, that they actually came from within as well, starting in southern Afghanistan. And I'm based on what you know, if Karzai loses the confidence of the people there, what happens then?
There's essentially two Afghanistans today. They're thriving cities. Kabul's, you know, doubled in population and full of aid workers and business. Rural Afghanistan, very little has changed, and that's the Taliban's support base, and that's an extremely conservative form of Islam. There are Taliban hardliners who invited, you know, Mr. bin Laden and his supporters in, and there's a real chance that both in Afghanistan and Pakistan, if the United States walks away, the hardliners will say, you see, they were just using us, mm-hmm. They can't be trusted, and that Sharia offers a better way of life. And that, in a sense, is the greater ideological struggle that's underway right now.
There's also a story from Washington. The president on a trip to the CIA is asked about bin Laden, speaks very rarely about the man, I think because it's seen as an ongoing, unresolved issue for him. But he says that he remains the greatest challenge of our day, finding Osama bin Laden. Evidence that is going on? I mean, do you see that on the ground as well?
There has been, but I recently, just last night, actually, Doug Feith, who from the Defense Department, was speaking, and he was praising Pakistan's cooperation in the hunt for bin Laden. But the recent developments, there's been a pattern of the Pakistanis doing the minimal amount they can when pushed or when there's a direct threat to kill President Musharraf. But when not pushed, the Pakistanis will back off. There's an area called South Waziristan where the Pakistanis deserve credit for going in. That's along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border on the Pakistani side of the border. There's been military operations there. The Pakistanis have lost 400 soldiers, but they've recently made a peace deal with local tribesmen there, one of whom fought alongside the Taliban, was actually in Guantanamo and then mistakenly released by the United States. It's a mixed record, and there's desire from some American officials for them to go into a place called North Waziristan. That's not happening. So the sense is that Mr. bin Laden is still in there somewhere, that he moved into that area after the Battle of Tora Bora and hasn't really moved since then. He's basically could be sitting in one small compound, and he's been very disciplined, not using any electronic communications, any way to trace him electronically.
When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about what's going on in Pakistan, the hunt for bin Laden, but concentrate, I think, this hour on talking about what obligation the U.S. has, in particular to Afghanistan, to continue to support democracy there, and what the alternative to that is. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. David Rode, the New York Times correspondent, currently on fellowship in Boston, is my guest. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join our conversation this hour. My guest, David Rode, New York Times correspondent, just completed 2.5 years working in South Asia, primarily in Afghanistan, Pakistan. That's what we'd like to focus on this hour, though he's been many other places. And we're going to start in Atlanta, Georgia, with KK, who's on the phone. Hi, KK.
Good morning. Good morning to both Mr. Gordon and Mr. Rode. So since we were talking about the Afghan democracy, one thing that, people confused the Al-Qaeda with the Taliban, I have not heard of any senior Taliban leader arrested in Pakistan ever since the war on terror began. And, I've contacted a few people, and everyone tells me, and there's a lot of writing, that virtually every senior Taliban commander lives in and around the city of Quetta in the Balochistan province of Pakistan. Yet I have not seen any of our major media, including the New York Times, actually go in and interview these people, on the record. Or is there some kind of unwillingness? Because is there a fear that the Pakistan government will just kick out people who point out that these Taliban leaders are living openly inside Pakistan?
Well, let's deal with some practicals first. David, do you know whether or not there are Taliban leaders who are in parts of Pakistan?
It's been widely reported, and KK, you're correct that Afghan officials say that these Taliban leaders are living in Quetta. The Pakistanis vehemently deny it and say it's not true.
How hard would it be, though, if you were to find a particularly well-plugged-in Pakistani journalist who could put you in touch with the fundamentalists, who could get you to these – could you do that story?
I wrote that story and interviewed two Taliban officials inside in a place that I – part of the agreement, unfortunately, was to not say where the location was, but it was outside of Afghanistan. And that was in August 2003, and they were promising that they were going to gain strength and gain support. And Quetta does seem to be a stronghold of theirs. I think on that same trip was when I had, I think that was what was the most disturbing experience of my time in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I was standing on the street in a part of Quetta where there's many young men from Afghanistan. Many of them openly said they were Taliban. Many of them said they were going to go fight in Afghanistan. Again, it's hard to know how much of this was bravado. And the call to prayer sounded, and this has never happened to me before in a Muslim country, but I was basically told to leave the entire area. I wasn't even in a mosque. because I didn't want, you know, I wasn't supposed to be near there. That's the kind of incredibly extreme form of Islam, and according to many, many Pakistanis and Afghans, it's not, you know, true Islam. Earlier in the day, I'd met a young madrasa instructor who was unaware of instructions in the Hadith where the Prophet actually explained how you can live peacefully with Muslims and Christians. I'm sorry, Muslims, Christians, and Jews living together. The Pakistanis I was with were horrified at his lack of knowledge at the religion. Anyway, the day ended with leaving the neighborhood after being ordered to leave, and the car window was down in my car, and there was a boy I saw driving as we just started to leave. I guess he was 10 or 12 years old, and as we left, he spit in my face. And it was this extraordinary, symbol of the incredible anger and hostility there. But also, you know, I think that boy was terrified of me. I think he thought I was an FBI agent that was going to come take him to Guantanamo. And everyone is sort of motivated by fear, I think, at a base level in this struggle. But Quetta is an enormous problem. I think there's more the Pakistanis could do. And then just to be fair to the Pakistanis, I think recently they are doing more. And the sense was that the Afghan elections, where the Taliban were unable to carry out any major attacks, that it was Pakistani cooperation that made that a success. That was just October last year. So it's slow improvement, but the Pakistanis can clearly do more.
KK, are you still there?
I'm still here. The thing is that regarding the elections, I read...
you mean the elections in Afghanistan?
The Afghan elections, yeah. Where the Taliban failed to carry out their promise to, you know, stop them or, you know, threaten them. I read that it was President Bush in an October 2004 meeting with President Musharraf, who's when he was here for the UN, said that, you know, you better stop it. And I guess I read somewhere that the Afghans at least took this as an indicator that the Pakistanis could turn off the tap and turn it on at will. But the point still remains that not a single top Taliban leader has been arrested in Pakistan, even though, you know, every Afghan, including Ambassador Khalilzad and American experts like Barnett Rubin, everybody says that these top Taliban leaders, Mullah X and Y, are living in this suburb of Quetta. And, in fact, the Pakistanis actually kicked out a couple of French journalists, and their Pakistani stringer actually had to flee to the United States under a false name to escape being imprisoned.
Well, one of the things that characterizes this part of the story, David, would be that Americans don't have the freedom of movement and decision making in Pakistan that they would in Afghanistan. I mean, they have to respect both the Pakistan government and the military there, do they not? I mean, doesn't that make it a little bit more difficult for them to operate independently?
It does, and the Pakistanis argue that Americans running around in big, you know, Chevrolets wouldn't find any of these guys anyway, because everyone would see them coming from miles away. In terms of senior Taliban leaders living in Quetta, the Pakistani response is, you know, give us an address. And I was actually given addresses of madrasas that were allegedly recruiting for the Taliban inside Pakistan, mm-hmm. From Western officials who wanted to remain anonymous. And when I went to check these out, and also from Afghan officials, you know, they didn't check out. That could mean that captured Taliban fighters are giving false information, and then it was relayed to me. But the bottom line is there's no question that Pakistan could do more. There's a sense that they were sort of playing a double game and sort of holding the Taliban in reserve, waiting. Actually, going back to this budget cut in aid to Afghanistan, there's a deep suspicion among the Pakistani leadership that the United States is not committed to the region and will walk away. And the sense, no one will say it publicly, but Pakistani analysts, independent analysts, think that the Pakistani military is holding the Taliban, you know, as a card to play in the future and not completely letting them be wiped out as an organization, because they fear the United States will walk away from Afghanistan, and Pakistan wants to have a way to influence Afghanistan. And they actually continue to see Afghanistan as a fallback and an important ally to have. They're very afraid of Indian influence in Afghanistan, and it's always important to see Pakistan's action in relation to its fear of India. So that's the sense. They've done better, and they should get credit for that. And the Afghan elections were a success, but it's a big question mark. And the administration has also has been at least publicly very, very supportive of them. Even last night, again, at this Doug Feith event, sort of lauding the Pakistanis, which many Pakistani observers think they should be much tougher on them.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. David Rode is my guest this hour. We're talking about his work in Afghanistan and Pakistan over the past 2.5 years and whether or not the United States government or this administration has shifted attention too far away from those two particular countries, whether or not the United States should do more to press Pakistan for the capture of Taliban leaders and bin Laden himself, who many suspect is found his home somewhere in Pakistan, close to the Afghan border. I want to, David, if I can, just before we go back to our callers, go back to that moment with you on the streets of Quetta. There has always been, in my own experience, and maybe I'm out of date with this, kind of a respect for people who are working as journalists in that part of the world, even from and among people who are not well-educated and among people who are particularly well-educated. Was that not there? Is that something that you've seen change?
I don't think that exists anymore. And I also would say it doesn't exist for Arab journalists also, who have had, and Pakistani and Afghan journalists who American forces have, you know, shot and killed in Iraq and arrested in Afghanistan. So it's we've all lost that anonymity. There's again, it's the nature of this conflict. There's so much fear and suspicion on both sides that you know, I'm assumed to be a CIA agent, and an Afghan journalist or an Iraqi journalist is assumed to be, you know, a dangerous, you know, Taliban or an insurgent. And so we've lost that.
And on the sort of suspicion gauge here, is it your experience that people that you've met, that you talk to in Pakistan, are more suspicious of Americans and soldiers, journalists, basically the relationship with the country than you'd find in Afghanistan?
In Pakistan, I would say yes. One of the interesting things, there's a deeper suspicion, I think, in Pakistan and the United States. It's one of the failures, I think, in the war on terror. I would say most Pakistanis that I spoke to, including professionals, including journalists, still believe that the September 11th attacks were carried out by the CIA and the Mossad creating a pretext to invade Muslim countries. That's widely believed still there. It's
among educated people.
It's widely reported in the Pakistani media. And there's an increasingly free media in Pakistan. I think that's good, and you just have to let these stories continue to be reported. I think it's a mistake to sort of shut down newspapers, yeah, as was done in Iraq. But it's a problem, and the negative perception of the U.S. remains extremely strong in Pakistan.
Let's take a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Reminder to our listeners, 1-800-423-8255. That's how you join us. Tim's on the line. Hi, Tim. What are you thinking?
Fine. I have a problem with President Bush. He waffles and he wavers. A couple months before the election, he said he's not concerned about bin Laden. Then they put us on a non-alert, but bin Laden made threats. It appears to me that they're not going after bin Laden like they should. It all started with the 911 incident. So I'm sort of like...
You think he should be still number one then?
Correct. I mean, now we've been in democracy in Iraq. More soldiers are dying. But you hear nothing about the Taliban, how close you are to bin Laden.
Right.
Then when we get a new threat, it goes like, well, I'm still we'll be worried about him. Something he said yesterday about day by day, but I'm just confused with him.
Well, there was a story, and just recently, I think, David, that even some of the top special forces people and the security, the American security people who were involved in the hunt for bin Laden were moved out of Afghanistan and into Iraq to make sure that there was no trouble during the January 30th election. Is there truth to that? Can you make the case that more resources could be put into the hunt for bin Laden?
That is true, and I've seen those stories, and we also ran one of those stories. There was a real drop in activity in terms of looking for bin Laden, especially in 2003 and part of 2002. There's now CIA teams that are operating in the tribal areas along on the Pakistani side of the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. And, you know, he remains, you know, an inspirational figure to what, you know, I see as an ideological movement. That's what we're battling here. It's not an organization, a top-down organization where bin Laden is giving specific orders for attacks. He inspires young men who And this is what's important, I think, to understand, is it's a very sophisticated pitch, in a sense, that they give these young men, that they are fighting for justice, that they are spreading a better, more fair way of life that will end corruption, equally distribute wealth, and give people a better life and give people more dignity. I mean, many of these fighters think that they're, you know, bringing dignity to women in particular, and it's very important to see it that way, and that's why I think the more successful efforts have been multifaceted, where it's a development, an aid effort for reconstruction. There's a political effort, and then there's also a military effort. Many scholars, you know, compare the movement to sort of it's the Marxism, you know, of today, where young men would be going and joining it. And they're not getting, I would say also in a hopeful tone, and even in Pakistan, they're not getting widespread public support. It's only a very small slice, I think, of Muslims that are joining this kind of radical movement.
Is it a big enough slice, though, to say that al-Qaeda remains a real threat? And when there are stories of bin Laden and his deputies talking about regrouping for another attack on the United States, that ought to be taken seriously?
I think it should be taken very seriously. I think, you know, bin Laden should remain the top target. And he did get some breathing space when there was the American focus on Iraq. And it's very – they're extremely dangerous. And the problem is it just takes a small number of them to carry out one of these attacks. So it's – but I just think it's important to see this not as an operation where if we just kill a certain number of al-Qaeda people, it will go away. They are gaining new recruits, not in massive numbers. And we need to dissuade – I'm sorry, we need to disprove the arguments they use. Actually, President Musharraf, the head of Pakistan, has really vocally called for more American effort to resolve what he calls these festering political disputes in the Islamic world. And the number one case he cites is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He also talks about the Kashmir struggle between India and Pakistan, the ongoing, you know, insurgency in Chechnya. So he's saying, I've had Pakistanis say, we are doing what you ask. We're arresting dozens of these guys, hundreds of these guys, but more of them keep joining. You have to address the root causes, poverty, anger, you know, resentment, and these political disputes that give people a sense that they're a victim of an aggressive and unjust United States that just humiliates them.
David Rode is my guest. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. Let's go to Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Mike's with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
I was just wondering what your guest thought about the basis of the resentment in the region. How much of it's built in the fact that a lot of Pakistanis, and I guess Afghanis, didn't think that we had much of a commitment after the Russians pulled out in 89? How much is that related to how we've acted since 9/11 and the interim there?
And the fear that the U.S. will bail at an inopportune time again.
Do the same thing, essentially, yeah.
You're absolutely right, and that's the perfect point. Is they see it like all of us. They see the world through their own experience. And I mean, Pakistanis literally talk to themselves like they describe Pakistan as a lover that the United States would woo and use and then walk away from, and that this has happened repeatedly. They actually blame the United States for creating the sort of culture of jihad in these madrasas in the 80s, which the United States did fund indirectly, to create young, motivated Mujahideen fighters to go kill Russian soldiers. And then after the United States helps create this infrastructure, you know, Pakistan is left to clean up the mess. So there's a tremendous well of resentment there and a tremendous distrust for the United States. And again, back to this funding issue, you know, again, dramatically cutting back funding in Afghanistan, you know, plays into those fears and makes people not want to take the risk of sort of supporting democratic reform, you know, or believing the Americans.
The Americans get no credit for raising the amount of economic involvement with Pakistan, because that has gone up in past years, right?
It has and it hasn't. And this is where, again, they catch us on hypocrisy. The United States has not reduced textile tariffs that would help Pakistan tremendously. And this is obviously a domestic issue in terms of jobs, but they want more. There's very little economic money going into Pakistan.
Pakistan now. David Rhodes, my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a chance to gauge the involvement of the United States with different parts of the war on terror. What is the danger of taking the eye and the forces and the attention and the money away from places like Afghanistan too early? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We'll be right back. My guest is David Rode, the foreign correspondent who, when he was working in the former Yugoslavia, won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the story in Srebrenica, where 7,000 Bosnian Muslims were massacred. He wrote a book about it called Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica. For the past 2.5 years, David has been based in South Asia, working for the New York Times. He's currently in Boston at the Kennedy School Shorenstein Center, taking a look at how media works in parts of the world down there. We may get a chance to talk a little bit about that later in the program. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to East Hampton, Massachusetts, and Bryce is with us. Hi, Bryce.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, you know, since you've been talking about Pakistan and the Bush support for their regime, I'm wondering what's behind that. Why are we supporting that regime, and is it similar to the reasons we may be supporting Saudi Arabia, and basically in that there's money and oil in it for us?
What's the alternative to the kind of support that Musharraf is getting right now from the U.S.? Am I missing the point of your question?
No, it sounded like you were indicating that there was perhaps a terrorist network that we were ignoring in Pakistan, and that perhaps Bush was just turning a blind eye to it and indicating continuing support. And I'm not, so that's my question.
Okay.
The immediate reason for the support of Musharraf is that he is seen as aggressively pursuing al-Qaeda. And there has been good cooperation. Again, there could be more done to actually find bin Laden himself, I think, up on the border. But in Pakistani cities, they've arrested very senior members, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the director of operations for al-Qaeda. And the sense is the United States is taking, very good cooperation on getting al-Qaeda and then sort of accepting that they were getting sort of mediocre cooperation on the Taliban. The sense on supporting Musharraf is that he's a military ruler. The Pakistan's army has, dominated Pakistan for most of its history since independence. And the civilian governments that ruled that the experiment with democracy in Pakistan did not go that well in the 1990s, when Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif were the prime ministers. And there's a sense that a military ruler is the only person that can sort of go after al-Qaeda and keep the all-important army behind this project. But many, many people, and Pakistani themselves are the most critical of this, say the army rule is not the long-term answer in Pakistan. There's got to be a shift to democracy eventually. That's the only way to truly stabilize the country. And the last thing and the most important factor in Pakistan is that it is the only Islamic country known to possess nuclear weapons. That is the most important thing in Pakistan. And there's a tremendous fear about instability in Pakistan. I think there's a very small chance of this happening, but somehow one of those nuclear weapons could end up in the hands of a terrorist.
You mentioned a little bit earlier, David, that there is a free press in Pakistan and pretty freewheeling, pretty critical of the government, at least they have been. You can bring us up to date on the latest. But also in Islamabad and Lahore, outspoken advocates of democracy and human rights. Are those voices being heard?
They are being heard, but there's a sense among them that the United States is not supporting them to the extent that they would like to see. And they're risking their lives. They're under, threat from militants. President Musharraf himself, there's been 2 assassination attempts. But the pro-democracy people feel like the United States is making a cynical, short-term bet, and this is what they repeatedly accuse the United States of doing again. There was also a military dictator, General Zia ul Haq, when the U.S. was training Mujahideen fighters and backing hardline Islam in the 80s. So they say the United States needs to take a longer-term, look at the region and help them. They are courageous people. There are raves in Karachi where young, Western-educated Pakistanis, go and, dance all night to Western techno music. There's a Karachi Film Festival. There's a whole group of moderate Muslim Pakistanis who are desperate for reform and desperate for our support, and we need those people. And what the moderates argue is that the West needs, again, to do more to resolve these political disputes, again, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Chechnya and Kashmir, to make their support for the West seem more legitimate. They are courageous people in Afghanistan and Pakistan who we cannot win this struggle without. There are Afghan soldiers dying. There are Pakistani soldiers dying. We need to support these moderates. We need to not stereotype Muslims. And, they're people that, have my unending respect.
Let's go to Holden, Massachusetts, for a call from Harriet. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, how Harriet. Hi, Dick. Sorry. A lot of my questions have been answered in the last two conversations, but I guess all things being equal, I'm wondering exactly what the United States can do to reduce the influence of the madrasas and to convince the Pakistanis that we are really genuinely interested in their well-being. I mean, you hear about moderation, and you hear about reducing the pressure of the militants and things like that. But if, in fact, we had a more sympathetic government who cared actually about these people, what specifically could we be doing in the short and the long run?
I believe that in Pakistan there could have been much more money going to education reform, economic reform. There are better trade, you know, relations that could be set up. Still, and this is obviously a political gamble, there's tremendous resentment. The number of Pakistanis applying to study in American universities has dropped by almost 50% because there's such a sense of being discriminated in the United States and the difficulties in getting a visa now. So there's a real sense that Muslims are being religiously profiled. And it would be, I think, to try to work to counter that. And American investment in Pakistan, American companies investing in Pakistan. When bombs are set off in Karachi, the militants don't, you know, want us to run away, want us to be afraid of Muslims, and want us to be divided. And I think, you know, that long-term commitment, you know, is the key, I think, in both countries.
You know, India and Pakistan started their own experiment with independence and democracy at about the same time. The Indian story is for another show, but you know, those elections take place. Parties, you know, different parties, different prime ministers seem to be able to replace one another without any kind of a bloodshed. Is there something that's missing on the Pakistan side? There is the free press. There is a court system that at times has functioned. What's the sort of winner-take-all aspect of the democracy there that never allows for an opposition group to be an opposition group?
It's fascinating to see how democracy has developed across South Asia, and this is, again, I think the challenge for the United States when it talks about spreading democracy around the world. It's not just holding elections. It's building up institutions in each of these countries, and it's creating a culture of compromise. And that doesn't exist today in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. There's no experience with democracy, and it's an issue also in Iraq. India has a very strong parliament, has a very strong Supreme Court, and has a very strong election commission. You'll see in other countries in South Asia, such as Bangladesh and Nepal, it's been a failure. The reason that there isn't such a strong public support for democracy returning to Pakistan is that because it was so much instability and a winner-take-all sense of democracy that it didn't seem to work.
And corruption, just beyond
belief, massive
corruption.
And that's the strongest appeal of the hardline religious parties, that we will deserve. And it's literally, this is about which system. Is it Sharia or is it sort of Western liberal, you know, democracy with capitalism will produce better schools, consistent jobs, decent municipal services, and a policeman that will not harass you on the street corner. And Afghans are thrilled because they're not being harassed by, you know, the moral police from the Taliban. But we need to work on those fundamentals. And I've had American military commanders in Afghanistan say to me, I am not going to win this struggle. It's the aid workers that are going to win this. It's the reconstruction people. And there is an American effort now to sort of support democratic institutions in both countries. One of the changes that's happened under the Bush administration is that there's many for-profit companies that are actually carrying out this work.
Okay, but we've got public investment. I mean, you're talking about public investment in public institutions. You're talking about private investment in these countries. You know that there is a sentiment in this country that particularly in a place like Pakistan that has such a history with corruption, that it's money down a rat hole, that it's lost money. It's going to end up in the wrong pocket. Can you make the case that the story is other than that?
I think it's getting better. I think there are individual businessmen that are less corrupt. And look, money went down a lot of rat holes during the Cold War, and I think this is just as serious a struggle. And money, aid money is going to be lost, and it's an issue, and investments are going to be lost. But I think the stakes here are that important, and it's got to be that kind of decades-long serious commitment to this, a sweeping effort at economic and political and social reform, along with a very serious military effort that will win this. It's got to be all those things. It can't just be a military effort. And we've got to engage. We've got to go there and I think and show faith in the moderates that are there.
1-800-423-8255. David Rode is here with me in the studio talking about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the U.S. involvement with those two countries. What are the alternatives? We're next in Cary, North Carolina, and Bonnie is with us. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. David, I have tremendous respect for you. I'm from India. I have lived in the U.S. for the past 10 years, and it's amazing how different U.S. governments behave as if the previous government's policies do not have anything to do with them. But for us who come from the region and who cannot tell the difference between the different political parties and their policies, it's a continuum. It doesn't matter whether it is Bush or Clinton's policy. It's seen as U.S. government policy. I'm hoping that David can say something about that.
The funny thing about my experience in South Asia and in India, but also particularly Pakistan, was people were incredibly friendly generally towards me as an American. The Americans are very much – people are very affectionate, and they say that Americans are very straightforward. We're also very naive is what they say. But and then they have an incredible anger towards American government policy, and there's a deep antipathy towards American policies in the region, and it's seen as hypocritical. It's that the United States has created a very fair system here that respects rights inside the United States for its own people, but its foreign policies is seen as more cynical, sort of using countries when they're needed and then walking away from them, again, to return to that theme. So you're right. I mean, there's a tremendous sentiment in the region and I think other parts of the world about, American sort of expediency. And people, it's changed. CNN and Fox even and the BBC are on, televisions in all these countries now, even in Afghanistan. And, when the president has a press conference or Donald Rumsfeld has a press conference, it's watched by Pakistanis and Afghans also. So
is that a good thing, though? Isn't that a good thing?
It is a good thing, but just their words are parsed. And, I mean, a pithy phrase that may sound, proudly patriotic to Americans sounds arrogant to people outside the United States. And it, having a sort of vision of a broader, politics is and the impact of our actions and statements abroad is, the world has shrunk.
Yeah, and we are thinking that's not what your president said 5 years ago, 10 years ago. I mean,
well, Bonnie, I mean, it happens in every democracy. I think you'd say that the BJP had a whole different outlook than Congress. It may just be that the policies of that government didn't have global implications.
That is true. But at the same time, India is not the one that is supporting, probably in Kashmir, but in other countries supporting fights against Soviet Russia or invading other countries. I'm totally opposite to the Iraqi war. So that is the sentiment that we see. Whatever we do, it's internal fight, mm-hmm. but we don't go and occupy or impose our policies on other countries.
It's especially the sense of the United States as an occupying power is something that I think Americans, it's very difficult to see us as that, but we are perceived widely overseas as a very dangerous, very powerful country that occupies other countries, not as a great force for democracy. So the president's pledges for spreading democracy are, is very positive. I think that's a very positive thing for people to hear. We need to follow that with actions that support it. Doug Feith talked last night about how the elections in Afghanistan spread hope. Across the region, they want democracy in Pakistan also, and we're now supporting a military ruler there. There should be a slow transition to democracy and a very serious focus on building up institutions there. But, that needs to happen. We need to be more serious about actually backing up our rhetoric.
I know one of the things that you've worked on, David, is the kind of for-profit rather than NGO not-for-profit, the for-profit reconstruction money that comes from Washington. Can it work? Or does that always just seen also cynically as a way of putting money in lobbyists' pockets in D.C.?
What's changed in the sort of nation-building effort, if you want to call it that, in Iraq and Afghanistan, there are for-profit companies, and there's no problem with for-profit companies sort of building roads and schools and electrical grids. No one can do that as well as they do. But right now, the education reform, judicial reform, and efforts to improve governance and increase local governments in Iraq and Afghanistan, the contracts have gone to big for-profit consulting companies
American
based in Washington.
Companies,
yeah. Yes, American companies. The argument is that they're private, so they'll be more efficient. But nonprofits and big sort of institutions, educational like universities, say that they don't have a long-term commitment to the region and that money's not saved because they take these huge, you know, sometimes 30% fees to do these things. So it's sort of nation-building incorporated or nation-building for profit. That's a big change under this administration. And I'd say there's a mixed record so far, at least in Afghanistan. And
Do people in Afghanistan look at these corporations as an opportunity to get a job, or do they look at these corporations as Americans in there making their own money without leaving perhaps what they could behind?
There's a deep and dangerous and growing resentment, a sense that the money is not ending up in Afghanistan. That only no one knows the exact numbers, but you know maybe half the money, or you know as little as a third of the money, ends up on the ground going to Afghanistan. And what you'll have is USAID contracting with a private company, the education company is called Creative Associates. They'll take 30% of the money for their administrative overhead, and then they'll just end up hiring many Afghan NGOs to do the teacher training on the ground. And it's just
– that 30% stays in America.
Yes. And that's the aid business, and that's sort of you know part of what's always happened. But it's a dangerous resentment that's growing there. And again, it's unusual that so many for-profits are – you know, everything's been so privatized. It's too early to tell, but there's massive contracts going out. And there's more importantly, there aren't enough actually companies and consultants to do all the democratization work that the United States wants to do now in Afghanistan and Iraq and other countries. And so the U.S. almost needs to build up a bigger capacity to have young people who know how to do this and a bigger expertise. The British, you know, had their colonial service. But if we're serious about democracy, we have to have a long-term commitment to doing it.
Peace Corps, too?
You know, that's the argument. And, you know, instead of private companies, what would you rather have, 5,000, you know, USAID employees doing this? I think it's a mix of the two. NGOs say that, you know, they would like a larger chunk of the pie and that there's bias against them. But we really need – I don't know, and it's something I'm actually thinking about now in this fellowship, how to do this best. But it's an enormous question. Again, it's easy to talk about spreading democracy. How do you do it? How do you train political parties? How do you create bar associations? How do you create – you know, community councils. And that's the grassroots, long-term thing that will hold together democracy.
So nice to have you here in the studio. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
David Rode, foreign correspondent for The New York Times, currently on a Shorenstein Fellowship here in Boston. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Pamela Ferdinand, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugar. It's Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.